to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spech.
Hello.
What's happening, Derek?
You know, I was just thinking, it's lucky to be living in Southern Ontario. I don't know if you've been seeing the news this week.
I've not been watching the news whatsoever.
No? So
I refuse to.
We were supposed to get snow today. It never really came. Had some flurries. But yesterday, I made note of the fact that... So Dwayne and Marion are getting their resort up and running, and yesterday, so it's spring, it's April. I don't know how much they got, but it looked like 2 feet of snow.
Oh yeah, far up there,
it
yeah.
was brutal.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of people are getting yeah. snow way up there.
It's like, whoa,
yeah. It's only spring in part of the country.
Yeah, it's only spring in some parts, not all of it.
Their groundhogs did not participate.
No. No. Sorry, Dwayne. Sorry, man.
Oh, well, as long as we're having fun down here.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It was just cold down here.
It was cold. It has been cold. And so, was it this morning driving to work, I saw cars with snow on the roofs. It's like cleared off. Mm. And today on the way here, I was in traffic with a bunch of transport trucks, and they all had like snow and ice hanging off them.
Yep.
Looks like they come through like a. Oh, I also saw a convoy of like, oh, had to be at least a dozen. Like I just kept passing them. All the linesman trucks. They are all from New Brunswick.
Oh, so coming in to help or heading home?
I assume they're coming. Well, they're heading west. So okay. I assume they're here to help. So I know Minnesota got really slammed, so maybe heading that way. I don't know. But also, like, they're up in...
What up near it? Georgian Bay and Georgian everything. Georgian Bay. And south of.
Yeah.
A lot of power out up there so, still.
Yeah. So I saw that, all these... They're all in the slow lane, just in a big convoy of all these hydro trucks with the buckets and stuff. So it's like, oh, they're going to help somebody.
Mm-hmm. Anybody riding in the buckets?
No. That'd be fun.
Wouldn't it?
Watch out for low bridges, though.
Well, you wouldn't be standing up. Just be sitting there. Maybe peek up once in a while. Right?
Lower the bucket. There's a
Throw
bridge.
Things at passing cars. What oh, the hell's yeah. that? Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have been following a different type of news because I got like an email saying, oh. Hey, did you know?
Oh, okay.
So there's a company called FeedSpot.
Yes.
They rank YouTubes and podcasts and blogs and TikToks yep. and podcasts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, hey, by the way.
We've had this rating.
Best rafting podcast, number one, Paddling Adventures Radio.
Cool.
Best canoeing podcasts, number one, Paddling Adventures Radio.
Very cool.
Best water sports podcast, number one, The Water Ski Podcast.
Okay.
Number two, The Ski Show, which is just fancy water skiing.
Yes.
Number three, Paddling Adventures Radio.
See? There's room for so improvement.
We're right up there. Room for improvement. Now, if we can add some water skiing to our paddling repertoire, as it were.
What was the group title? It was not the podcasters. What was the group title?
Best Water Sports Podcast.
Water Sports Podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are just podcasts. They mm-hmm. don't put, then it would be another sort of thing for TikToks
yeah.
and YouTubes. And like they're not... combined
so
all of them.
We've seen lists similar where it's opinion based. This is mm-hmm. not opinion based. This is
basic
statistics,
metrics, and, stuff.
Metrics yeah. and statistics.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So, yeah. Those water skiers, curse you.
Just means there's room for us to improve.
Show skiing is one of the best disciplines of water skiing in the industry today.
Show skiing.
Yeah.
Like people that do the jumps. Like
I'm thinking.
You know, you got a big ramp on the water.
Water ski legends, Hall of Famers, and rising stars in our sports. And they don't really actually say what it is, but that's the impression I get.
Because they do slalom, they do jumps, they do stunts.
They get 15 women standing on each other's shoulders behind a boat from the 50s.
From the 50s, yes. Yes.
That's what started it all, baby.
Yeah. I think there was an Elvis movie with that in it once.
Oh, I think you're right. Anyways, that's...
very cool.
That's what's new here. Anyway.
So we can do better.
Right? In the water sports podcast. Excellent. Excellent. Just something that came my way and thought I'd throw out there.
That's pretty neat. It kind of gives you a little bit of a little bit of boost. It's like, oh, it's not just my mother that listens type thing, right?
Right.
And if my mother doesn't even listen anymore.
And I don't even know if mine does. other than that.
Cool. I'm looking forward
to... That's all I got this week.
Looking forward to a warmer spring. Was it, you know, the April showers bring May flowers? Like, let's bring that
on.
Yeah,
it's been up and down right now. But you got to think, like, fall is the exact same thing, just in reverse.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not like one day all of a sudden, boom, there's snow and it's absolutely below zero freezing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not going to be boom, all of a sudden it's warm and above zero.
Yeah. And the concern also is if you get too warm of an early spring and you get a cold snap, it really messes up crops in the area. Like, Bowmanville is filled with apple orchards, Algoma and whatever. There's like, you know, thousands of acres of apple orchards all over the place. And if we get a late spring frost, mm-hmm. it just kills all the blossoms and it ruins the crop. So hopefully when it does warm up, it's consistently warm and paddlers are able to get out. The apple orchards are able to grow their apples, yada, yada, yada.
You just want to get out in your Speedo. Strutting through the neighborhood.
I've never owned one.
Flip-flops and a Speedo.
I've never owned one.
So you go naked is what you're saying.
My Speedo was a thong.
My Speedo's just... And I wear it backwards. Ooh. On another note.
Visualize that.
It's not Halloween. Ooh, spooky. That's not a horror movie you need to be watching. What do we got? We got a few things this week.
We might.
One or two things, right? You're looking to paddle, or you're looking for ways to explore some of the U.S. national parks without crowds that congregate at the viewpoints and visitor centers and on the trails and such. You know, we're pushing everybody, get outside, and we're sort of our own worst enemies, because then... You go outside and there's people.
There's too many people.
There's two people out there. Well, now maybe it's time to trade your hiking boots for a paddle. Many of the hiking trails in the national parks are seeing record numbers of people. So bring your canoe or kayak with you on your next national park vacation. Experience the wilderness from a different perspective. Of course, not all national parks are conducive to canoe and kayak trips. Many of them are. And once you're out on the water, you'll find amazing views and fewer people, which is nice. They have a list here of a few of the best national parks for kayaking and canoeing in the United States, followed by some tips for paddling the parks. So the first one, which is a biggie, Everglades National Park in Florida.
You ever been?
No. No, I've never been to Florida.
John Van Berger talked
care
about...
Care to say his name 15 more times?
Yeah, I know. I couldn't say it. John Van Berger. He talked about this a lot. He's been there a few times. I think he was with Alan once, didn't he?
Yeah, they met down that way.
Mm-hmm.
Best time to paddle. And they say they give the best time to paddle for all these, but it doesn't mean that's the only time you can paddle.
Yeah.
December through April.
It's the ideal time where I think everything is taken into consideration, whether it's like hurricane season or bug season or alligator season or boa constrictor season.
Right? These days. Is it boa constrictors or pythons?
Pythons, that's it. Yeah. Thanks for the correction.
They're both big snakes that want to eat you, so...
It's a python that is an invasive species, and they have contests who can catch the biggest one. And
oh, there's that TV show, Swamp People.
Oh, yeah.
With Troy.
Yeah.
Troy... Oh, I can't remember his last name.
I don't know.
French, though. They go there once in a while and help out getting rid of the big snakes and stuff. And that's pretty neat to see. Freshwater marshes, mangrove forests, and open waters of Florida Bay Everglades National Park offers paddling opportunities for everyone, whether you want an easy afternoon paddle or a multi-day adventure. There's an Everglades paddling trail with your name on it.
Hmm.
Derek's Trail.
Yes.
You've got several options for getting out on the water in Everglades National Park. You can bring your own kayak or canoe and launch from several areas within the park, or you can rent boats for your adventure. So that's the thing, is you end up going, oh, I wish I would have brought my own.
Mm.
But at least you know going to places like this, chances are you're going to be able to...
You'll be able to rent them.
Be able to rent them somewhere. Yeah. Various companies rent single kayaks, tandem kayaks, and canoes for full day or multi-paddling adventures. The park is one of the best national parks for kayaking through the winter. For more detailed trip guides, consider purchasing Paddling Everglades and Biscayne National Parks before your trip.
Cool.
This Falcon Guide is a full of detailed information as well as ideas for where to camp and how to string together routes for amazing multi-day trips. That's always handy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Big Bend National Park in Texas. Cool. Best time is September to February. So these are going to be good for people that are planning end of year stuff.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Because not everybody takes all their vacation.
What river is Big Bend on?
It's Big Bend National Park. It's like an expedition to the last frontier. It is wild and rugged with a few great opportunities to get out on the water. If you're looking for a multi-day adventure that doesn't require a lot of experience, we definitely recommend a 33-mile float trip through Boquillas, I think that's how you pronounce it, Canyon. This is a 2 to 4 day trip with rapids up to class 2. Paddlers can camp along the Rio Grande.
The Rio Grande River. Yeah. Yep.
Which divides the United States from Mexico. The canyon walls are more than 1,200 feet high in some places, making it one of the most scenic river trips in the country.
That'd be amazing.
There are also lots of hiking opportunities along this stretch of the Rio Grande. But to paddle through the canyon, you will need a wilderness permit from the National Park Services. You can't just up and go. Incredible Paddle Through Big Bend National Park is a one-way trip, so you'll have to bring two cars or arrange for transportation back to your car. People like Wild Adventure Outfitters can arrange a shuttle for you and provide boat and or gear rentals for your river trip. So if you just happen to find yourself down there and go, you know what, we got a few extra days. Let's go rent a boat, some gear, and paddle on down. Acadia National Park, Maine. Best time is June through September. So
I've been there.
That's coming up. One. Acadia National Park is located on the Atlantic coast in down east Maine. It's a popular national park for hiking, biking, and paddling. And hopping in a canoe or kayak is a great way to find solitude and wildlife. You can easily explore some of the small lakes and ponds in Acadia in the afternoon. Or if you have more time and experience, check out the small islands along the Wild Atlantic coast around Mount Desert Island. Almost said Desert Island.
Mount yummy.
Desert Island. Oh, that'd be a grand place to live. If you don't have your own boat for kayaking in Acadia, you can rent sea kayaks, canoes, and even stand-up paddle boards in the community surrounding the park. Guided tours are also available, which are particularly useful for navigating the tides of the Atlantic. So for people who come from, you know, mid-country, where tides are not a thing, you might want to consider a guided tour, and your tour guide will know all about tides and stuff like that. Biscayne Bay National Park, Florida. December through April is the best time. This park is located on the Atlantic coast of South Florida, within sight of the Miami metropolitan area. Protected area encompasses coral reefs, beautiful islands, and incredible historic sites. It's also 95% water, which makes it a perfect destination for all types of paddling. I don't know why, but just one of those things. The East Coast of North America, I never think of coral reefs.
Yeah, well, yeah, you have to be down Florida ways. You have to, it's tropical.
Yeah, but I just, but it, I just
you don't
never
think
of
it, I know.
Coral reefs.
Like, yeah, because...
I think Hawaii, Australia,
exactly.
Zealand,
yeah.
Stuff like that, right?
You think Atlantic Coast is like cold water.
Yeah. Yeah, seal reefs. note that canoe and kayak rentals aren't currently available in Biscayne National Park. If you have your own boat, you can park a car at the visitor center or at Black Point Marina. Novice paddlers will love exploring the mangrove and shallow bay of the park, and experienced paddlers will have no problem crossing Biscayne Bay to explore the islands. Once you make the crossing, pitch your tent on either Boca Chica or Elliott Key for $25 a night. From here, you can explore the shallow lagoons, creeks, and islands that make this park so special. Hmm. That sounds cool.
Mm-hmm.
This one, Canyonlands National Park, Utah. This is where we were looking at going there last summer. May through June and September through October. Canyonlands National Park is part of the high desert of the Colorado Plateau in southeastern Utah and one of the best national parks for kayaking on the Colorado River. This dramatic desert landscape has been carved into three distinct areas by the Green and Colorado Rivers. Two deep canyons rise up from the riverbank, and the landscape at the bottom of the canyon differs drastically from the arid climate above. Paddling the flat waters of the Green or Colorado through Canyonlands National Park is a unique way to experience this gorgeous landscape. Permits are required to float in the park, and access areas are located above the park, either in Moab for the Colorado River trips or Green River State Park for the Green River trips. Best way to tackle this easy float trip is to paddle downstream and then arrange for a jet boat to shuttle you back to the launch. Well, yes. Trips can be arranged for an afternoon or several days. Take me 7 hours to get there and 15 minutes to get back. If you plan to camp, it's best to plan for a time when the water isn't at its highest so you can pitch your tent on the plentiful sandbars. Yeah, I was looking all through this area, and I so want to go here. Just the scenery and the paddling looks just phenomenal. And there's a lot of spots that run by the roads. So if you do the Google Maps,
yeah,
you can travel the road and look at the rivers and stuff where you'd be going.
Yes.
Which is cool.
It's amazing. I would like to go there.
North Cascades National Park in Washington. Best time to paddle, July and August. Perfect time for summer vacay.
Mm-hmm.
North Cascades National Park is a vast tract of wilderness in the Pacific Northwest of Washington State. Not only does the park contain more than 300 glaciers, but is also home to wild old growth forests, countless waterfalls, and beautiful fjord-like lakes. It's one of the best national parks for kayaking in the western United States. Paddling day trips on Diablo Lake launch from Colonial Creek Campground, but if you want to spend more than a day on the water, you have to check out either Ross Lake or Lake Chelan, which both have primitive campsites available, and a wilderness permit is required. Ross Lake is 23 miles long with 19 boat-in campsites. You can spend 3 to 5 days paddling the lake and hiking numerous trails along the shore and into the wilderness. If you have your own boat, you can launch Colonial Creek Campground, but you can also rent a canoe or kayak. That sounds pretty cool. That sounds more like what we'd be doing around here maybe, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Voyageur National Park, Minnesota. That's getting closer to home. July through September. Summer vacation time. If you want to get away from the bustle of daily life, there's no better destination than Voyageur National Park. With 200,000 acres of ponds, lakes, and rivers, not to mention secluded primitive camping, this is a paddler's dream vacation, one of the best national parks for canoe and kayak camping. This is exactly what we do here. Explore the lakes and ponds of Voyageur, and you will have a chance to sight bald eagles, moose, bears, wolves, lynx, otters, and beavers, not to mention more than 240 species of birds.
Oof.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You can bring your own boat or rent a canoe from National Park Service for backcountry use. If you want to explore the larger lakes surrounding Voyageur National Park, Cabotagama, Rainy, Namakan, and Sand Point, you will have to rent a canoe from a private outfitter. There are water taxis and shuttles that can bring you directly to front country campgrounds within the park. Backcountry campsites can only be accessed by canoe and may also require hiking and portaging.
Huh.
That sounds cool.
It is very cool.
And something like that is like, we do this all the time, but this would just be a brand new location.
So it's a new location, but so it's one of the things that we don't really have that same type of opportunity because of the zones. Like for us, we have a hard water season. We don't really have access to excessive amount of winter paddling unless you have a wetsuit on and you go mm-hmm. and play in the waves on the bigger lakes and stuff like that. But what's amazing is that it doesn't matter what time of year, you could find some place, some national park in the States to a place to paddle where, you know, in middle of our winter, you can head down to, you know,
Florida.
Like Florida, Texas, and mm-hmm. so on, right? And then in the normal camping seasons, you were able to, you know, more normal areas like, for example, Maine. And that's one of the things I was looking up. I was trying to remember. I remember in the mid-late 80s, I'd been to Acadia a couple times. And I was like, I remember camping in a desert. So I had to look it up. And it's called Mount Desert Campground. And so it's a desert. Well, they call it a desert, but it's just a lot of sand dunes. And,
right.
And it's basically an island. Acadia is an island. It's Bar Harbor. I remember driving up the top of Cadillac Mountain on that island, and it's like my car was overheating because it's such a long drive up to the top and stuff like that. So this is back in the 80s. Back in my high school girlfriend, we were tripping down to Maine and going camping and checking things out. So it kind of brings back a lot of memories. Plus, I did some sailing from New Brunswick down to Bar Harbor, Maine, and so spent some time on the water out in the Atlantic. And so, yeah, it kind of brought back memories. And one thing I want to mention so we've mentioned all of these national parks. One thing for anybody interested in going to any of these, you need to really look ahead because there may be limited availability to mm-hmm. due to like staffing issues and so on.
Well, in places like Everglades, some of them are only so many people per day.
Yes. So is there a limited amount of people
based out?
They want to take the pressure off the environment mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Yeah. And places to stay are limited.
Yeah.
So you can't have 50 people going in if there's only seven
exactly.
places to camp.
We talked about a mountain lake recently. Is it Crater Lake?
A mountain lake?
Yeah, it's up at the top of the mountain. I think it's called Crater Lake. So one of these lakes, they're shutting down in 2026, and it's going to be shut down for 3 years.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's too much pressure on the yep. lake. Too many people are going to it. So they're saying, you know what? You guys are not allowed to touch the water for the next 3 years. So from 2026 to 2029, they're keeping people, you can't swim, you can't paddle, you can't do anything on the water.
You got to stay away from it.
And it's just being overused, right? People love their outdoors too much, and it does put a lot of pressure.
I think that's maybe going to become more of a thing.
Going forward, I think so too. Like there's a lot more people getting out. There's a lot more interest in getting out into these wild places, and unfortunately, we're loving these wild places to death.
Yep.
So it's if we could be more responsible while we're out there, there'd be less chance of them being shut down because of the overpressure on the areas. But it is what it is. People are going to get out there and enjoy
the outdoors.
More
people want to be too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but you just have to be responsible for it.
Just do your advanced checks and research before you
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
So if you're ready to explore some of the best paddling routes the national parks have to offer, whether you're an advanced or novice paddler, with or without your own boat, there's a national park paddling adventure out there waiting for you.
Absolutely.
Derek. speaking of paddling and resurgence, as spring brings longer days and milder temperatures, urban dwellers are rediscovering the joy of outdoor activities. While running and cycling remain staples of Beijing's fitness scene, a quieter and yet growing trend is unfolding on the water. Against Beijing's iconic skyline, Chaoyang Park offers a rare urban oasis where colorful kayaks and paddle boards dot the lake as more residents embrace water sports. It's picking up. It really is becoming a lot more popular.
And that's everywhere in the planet. It's amazing how it's really expanding. People are sort of rediscovering. There was a surge back in the 60s and 70s of... I think it's just due to movies and stuff like Burt Reynolds, was it Deliverance and so on. Like people, oh, look at that. I could go paddling. Mm-hmm. And there was different activities and a lot of stuff. The Olympics made things big. But then it kind of quieted down in the 80s and 90s. And it's really coming back.
Yeah, ever since COVID, everything's coming back. Everybody wants out.
Suddenly everybody goes, oh, we can do stuff outside.
Yeah, cheaper. Even complete beginners like me can pick it up quickly, and the stunning views make it for such a relaxing experience, says one local paddler. The rising tide of interest in water sports is driving demand for coaches, clubs, and equipment, creating a host of new opportunities in this sector. We kicked off this year's boating season in March and expect to see 200 to 300 visitors per day during the summer peak, said Cheng Hilong, founder of Beijing Whale Sports Club, which offers kayaking, rowing, stand-up paddleboarding, and various other water activities. With four bases operated across Beijing from March to October, the club expects to host around 30,000 participants this year.
It's a big number.
30,000 people out there.
Mm-hmm.
Since opening our first base in Chaoyang Park in 2018, we've seen growth in enthusiasm for water sports, Cheng says. With support from national and local sports bureaus, we've organized multiple paddleboard competitions to promote aquatic activities. You start growing the sport, starting to get more people interested, and then it breaks off into different things there, like racing and recreation.
Yes.
Chaoyang Park Paddleboard Hub, the Liang Ma River has become another popular water recreation spot for locals and visitors. Winding through diverse areas from embassy compounds and luxury hotel clusters to busy shopping districts, the river now attracts kayakers, paddleboarders, and sightseeing boats. Could you imagine if there was a big river that went from Toronto Harbor straight up? Like straight north, like basically followed Yonge Street, like right through the city, not, you know, to either side sort of deal.
Did you look at the map of Chaoyang Park?
Yeah.
It's interesting. So there's a couple water routes into and out of it, but it's amazing that, I don't know, maybe it's my ignorance of the topic, but I'm looking at the map now, and I see how many parks are in Beijing itself. Mm-hmm. And you think there's millions of people in this area, and it's highly densely packed with people. There's a lot of parks.
There's
a lot of green space.
Well, that's where you got to get your green space. You got to put it where you can, right?
Yeah.
Because it's so far to get out of the city.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice looking park.
Mm-hmm. In 2019, Chaoyang District launched a comprehensive waterfront revitalization project. Blah, blah, I say that word. Revitalization project. Thanks to sustained ecological restoration and careful urban planning, the river has been transformed from a polluted, sediment-choked channel into a serene retreat for city dwellers. While Beijing's water sports scene is on the rise, Shanghai, already a city deeply connected to its waterways, continues to expand its offerings. 2024 head of Shanghai River Regatta, for instance, transformed the bustling downtown stretch of the Suzhou River into a 4.2-kilometer race course, winding past centuries-old historical landmarks such as Wai Baidu Bridge and Shanghai Postal Museum. The event attracted elite rowing teams from around the world, including the British and Australian national teams, as well as crews from the University of Cambridge and Oxford Brookes University. Racing through Shanghai's city center was an incredible experience. The winding course was challenging, and the cheering crowds made it even more exciting. I'd love to return, said a British rower after the race. The event's impact extends beyond sport itself. According to the Shanghai Sports Bureau, the 2024 Head of Shanghai River Regatta, along with the 2024 Shanghai Marathon and the 2024 Shanghai Sailing Open, generated direct economic benefits of about $134 million U.S. dollars. Oof. That's a lot of money coming into the local economy. This aquatic enthusiasm has gone viral. Kayaking-related hashtags on Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, have amassed nearly 1.2 billion views, and the trend isn't limited to megacities. China is using nationwide programs to nurture a new generation of water sports enthusiasts. In 2024, over 2,000 youths from more than 20 provinces and cities joined surfing and stand-up paddleboard camps organized by the Water Sports Management Center of the General Administration of Sports in China. Meanwhile, 79 universities incorporated these activities into their curriculum. Key measures include improving public access through better facilities and specialized programs, boosting the market by integrating water sports with tourism and leisure activities, and promoting sustainable growth through better safety standards and government support. According to the China Outdoor Sports Industry Development Report, more than 1 million people in China consumed surfing and paddleboarding goods and services, 23 and 24.
Huh.
It's becoming huge. And you know what? It's nice to see countries that recognize that it is becoming more popular and are throwing all these programs out to make it even more and get their population out there and engaged, outdoors,
healthy, exactly.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, if you see, especially the youth, right? I mean, you get them involved now, and it'll be a lifelong thing, you know, like for most of them.
The Utes.
The Utes. Oh, that was a good movie. The Utes. Let's get a little bit closer to home here. There's a new book out, which you might want to buy but not read. New book tells the tales of canoeing stories across Minnesota. Pushing the River by author Frank Beers has just been released. It says much of the book focuses on the lost history of the Paul Bunyan Canoe Derby, an annual 450-mile race on the Mississippi River. There's a lot of things that go on in that Mississippi River.
It's a pretty big river. A lot of room for stuff to go on.
It's a long one from what I understand, too.
Yes.
It's the old MISSIPPIIPPISSISSIM.
Wow.
That goes back to grade 8. So they would start in Bemidji. How do we say that was?
Bemidji.
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 Yeah, it's just a weird looking name.
I just think of the mosquito or the bug. Bingy.
Bingy?
Bemidji.
Midges.
Little tiny midges.
Midges. Bemidji. About 10 days out, the race and down day by day and stay overnight in different places, including St. Cloud. When they reach Minneapolis, that would mark the start of the Aquitennial celebration.
I have to Google that word.
By the time they got there, people had been reading about it for 2 weeks and hearing about it on the radio. So there would be crowds for the final sprint of like 20,000 to 100,000 people watching these guys race down the river. He says big crowds all along the river came out to watch the competitors. There were big crowds in all the towns they would stop in, Grand Rapids, Jacobson, Aitken, and there would be 2,000 to 3,000 people out. There was a newspaper story in 1960 where there were 4,000 people in St. Cloud watching the racers come through. It was a big deal all the way up and down the river. It is a long. This is like 80 years ago now, 85 years ago now.
It's incredible. I just think about all the history that.
Like 1980s wasn't like a decade ago.
I know.
Anymore.
1900s.
the 1900s. So I saw a thing about that. Yeah, somebody said, can we use information from the 1900s? And then it hit me.
can we do research back then?
Yeah, can we go way back to the 1900s?
Ancient history.
He says the race had about 20-year span, starting in 1940 and running until about 1960. It ran from 1940 to 42, then was suspended by World War II. They restarted the race in 46 and ran continuously until 52. After a short stint of trying motorized races, they went back to the canoe races from 59 to 60. A number of canoes that competed in the race each year varied from about 10 to about 50, but many wouldn't survive the first few days of the race.
Wait a sec.
The boats or the people? It says the Paul Bunyan Canoe Derby was based on a race that started back in the 1920s. A similar short race called Minnesota Paddling Opener, which is 145 miles from Brainerd to Champlain, will be held in June. This June.
Oh, yeah, yep.
He says those organizers are toying with bringing the 450-mile Paul Bunyan race back in a few years. That'd be something to see.
That would.
I don't know that I'd participate, but it'd be something to see. Especially with the old, not many would survive the first few days. That sort of puts a damper on things when it comes to canoe racing for me. Yeah. Come join this race. You'll have a blast. You'll see tons of spaces. You might die in the first few days, but if you don't, it'll be grand. Here's your participation medal. Pushing the River. Go buy that book. It was just released today.
Oh, the Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, April 8th. Yep. Yeah. Pushing the River. Go check that one out and let us know if it's a good book. Because, you know, I might read it. Derek won't. Let us know if there's pictures and then Derek will buy it.
I'm reading more books.
Are you?
I am.
Like owner's manuals of a fridge?
That too.
Right?
That too.
Yeah, that doesn't count as a book, buddy.
Fridges are so bad for the ice makers these days.
Why would you have an ice maker in the fridge?
Where would you put it?
Just get an ice cube tray and put it in the freezer.
Manual labor.
You have water dispenser on your fridge, don't you?
Yes, I do.
You have little push button things on your fridge, don't you?
I guess. You can turn the ice maker on and off, and you can go from cubed ice to crushed ice to water, and you can change from Fahrenheit to Celsius. Just push buttons. There's no screen.
Yet.
The fridge came with a house. I didn't buy the fridge myself.
Yeah, but you like it.
I do.
You're going to upgrade it. I know it.
No, fridges are expensive. It's got a break.
Okay, what episode is this? 477?
477.
April 10th, 477. Derek said, no, he's not going to upgrade to better.
If it breaks, I will. I'm not going to purposely go out and shop for a fridge that I don't need.
Yeah, but if that breaks, you're getting a fridge with a screen and
no,
Bluetooth.
Too much to break. No, there's too much stuff to break.
Episode 477, April 10th. Derek said it here. So, yeah, check out the Paul Bunyan Canoe Derby book.
It's, it's the Aquatennial. It's a made-up word, like the centennial.
Well, I figured as much.
Yeah, so it's just the Minneapolis Aquatennial. It's an annual outdoor festival celebrating the city's lakes, streams, and rivers. Originated in 1940 as a way to boost civic unity and promote Minneapolis as a summer destination, particularly after the 1934 Teamsters strike.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a strike that brought anti-union violence to town, and then they just started doing, you know, water stuff to make it an aquatennial.
Did they just use the water stuff to cool things down?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a lot of union leaders got drowned.
They're in little barrels at the bottom of the lake. It's like Lake Powell.
Yeah. Is it Lake Powell that has? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they were finding the one that was drying out.
Yeah.
That and sunken boats.
Hey, there's bodies in this.
Hey, there's that's where they hid them. I'm surprised they never found good old what's his name.
He's there's so many rumors about him. You know, some stadium he's in the end zone, buried in concrete underneath the stadium. Yeah. Yada yada yada.
Where's Jimmy?
I don't think anybody ever find him.
Anybody seen Jimmy Hoffa?
Ooh.
He's sleeping with the fishes in a barrel in Lake Powell. All right, a little bit of history to go on the day.
Ooh,
not just Paul Bunyan. Paul Bunyan and his.
More stuff
big
found.
Blue ox. There's a big ox named Blue.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Bronze Age Scandinavians may have traversed from Denmark to Norway directly over the open sea on large canoes, scientists now say. The cultures of people from this time in northern Denmark and southwestern Norway were alike, with similar artifacts, burial systems, and architecture. Till now, researchers thought the cultural exchange between the two regions was very likely made possible by vessels traveling along a specific long route. This was a 700-kilometer route following the coastline of Scandinavia across Denmark, up the coast of Sweden, back down to southwestern Norway. However, a new simulation suggests ancient people in these regions may have also traveled directly between the two sites, crossing more than 100 kilometers of open ocean. 100 kilometers really, these days, doesn't really seem like that.
Doesn't seem like a lot, but back in
back
that day?
Back in the day? Yeah. For their study, scientists developed a computer program that assessed factors like current and wind, along with data on how a vessel moves through the water. They simulated trips using a reconstruction of a Hjortspring boat, a large paddle-driven canoe used around 350 BC.
And it would be, everybody would be best served if they Googled Hjortspring boat,
yeah.
H-J-O-R-T spring boat. These are really nice-looking canoe-type boats. They look very much Egyptian.
Yeah. The vessel is a planked wooden boat more than 62 feet in length overall, 13.6 meters or 45 feet along inside, and 6.6 feet wide. Planking is joined by sewing using a beveled lap joint similar to clinker construction.
Whatever okay. That is.
10 thwarts could have served as seats. They span the boat with room for two persons each. This suggests space for a crew of at least 20 who propelled the boat with paddles. Boat would have weighed an estimated 1,170 pounds, making it easily portable by its crew.
Easily portable.
Okie dokie. Well, they were big, giant Viking guys then. Well, it probably took two of them to carry it, one at each end.
And there's 20-plus people on the boat. So I guess.
You're only, plus gear.
Yeah, 1,000 pounds.
Oh, easy peasy lemon squeezy. Yeah.
50 pounds each.
Right. Researchers compared direct open waterway journeys, 110 kilometers, and coast-hugging, 700-kilometer voyages between Jutland and southwest Norway in the early Nordic Bronze Age. These two areas are known to be closely connected in the latter part of the Stone Age throughout the Bronze Age between 2350 BC and 1500 BC.
That's a long time ago.
Right?
Holy cow.
The latest simulations show Bronze Age people likely had the ability to travel directly from Denmark to Norway over the open ocean. These trips would have required a boat capable of navigating in waves up to a meter high and winds of up to 10 knots, along with good weather forecasting and navigational skills. The direct open ocean crossings were likely limited to the summer months, well, I would think.
Yep.
The trips would have taken many weeks to complete and required frequent stops to restock supplies. Successful journeys needed crews with extensive maritime know-how and seafaring skills, the scientists say.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I Googled the pictures of these giant canoe things, it just really struck me how amazing the construction was.
Mm-hmm.
And it did have a lot of earmarks of what I would expect to see on like the Nile River in Egypt and stuff. It was just like, whoa, look at that.
They would have to have a really good handle on weather and seasons.
Yes.
Now, I know a lot of the ancient like pagan religions and stuff, everything revolved around seasons.
Yep.
And so if you're going into the seasons and knowing what's coming and when you got to do your sowing and your harvesting and all that sort of stuff, you got to have a good handle on weather.
Did it say how high these canoes, these boats drafted above the waterline?
I think that would just be depending on what they were carrying.
Because if you have a 40, 45 foot long boat,
mm-hmm.
it's so a normal 12 to 18 foot canoe is going to ride a swell right away, right? But these things could span.
Well, these were 62 feet on the outside.
Okay.
45 feet on the
inside. So, because, so you could be spanning several waves. So the wave would just run down the boat. And depending on how high the wave is, you're just going to get a whole bunch of water inside.
Well, they were 6.5 feet high.
Okay, so that's why I asked about how high they are, how much drafted.
Like how high, but I mean, it depends on how much, if they were filled with gear coming home, like how much weight would sink that below, right? I mean, if they're going empty,
Bob Lexico.
Just like all the old Vikings in there. But, yeah, I mean, they would definitely have to have a really good handle on weather and seasons to know when they could make those trips.
Yep.
You know, because otherwise...
You're going to get yourself in trouble.
Yeah. You knew you weren't coming.
You're not calling rescue.
Like, you don't want to be the first boat out and the last boat in. You want to be somewhere, a couple of trips during the middle of the season.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's pretty interesting. I came across something we've never really talked about because I'm not really into it.
Mm-hmm.
But people are. I'm not Judgy McJudgerson.
You are.
I am. Judgy McJudgerson. We're not talking about this now. No, it's actually not something I've ever really thought about.
Not me. Me neither. So... There's issues with it for balance and popping a hole in your watercraft and oops.
Why hoof it through the woods? A well-rigged kayak lets you cruise up to turkeys while everyone else is sipping their morning joe, says Wesley Littlefield of Gear Junkie. Most turkey hunters overlook one of the most effective tools, the kayak. See, because I think hunting, it's illegal to be traveling up and down in your vehicle,
see
a deer on the side, and shoot them from your vehicle.
Yeah, you can't do that.
So, to me, it would be the same sort of thing...
On a watercraft.
On a watercraft, wouldn't it?
But also...
I guess not. Because, I mean, duck hunters and stuff, usually they're in a blind, are they not?
In a boat, in a blind.
I mean, I'm gonna totally profess my ignorance on
on
hunting and stuff. You know, I just don't do it. I've never taken an interest in it. I'm not going to judge people who do it. That's their hobby.
A buddy of mine, he's got like a 12, 14-foot flat-bottomed swamp boat type thing, and he just puts trees and reeds and stuff along the edge of the boat, and so he builds his blind, and he's sitting in a boat. But he's hidden behind these trees he's chopped down to make a wall. So it's, you can do it from a boat. It's just, I'm thinking from a kayak, though, if you're popping off shotgun rounds from, some of these fishing kayaks or whatever that you're going to use, I assume they're going to be using one of these more stable fishing kayaks.
I would think so.
Because I'm just
and they
thinking.
Probably have more skill than me at eating today because I dropped... soup and spaghetti and coffee all over my shirt today. So you wouldn't want me with a shotgun in a kayak. I'm telling you that right now.
Especially like one of those thin, those narrow, like sea kayaks or, you know, just a sit on top.
No, these are like kayaks.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Those things are stable.
Yeah. When properly rigged, a kayak becomes your stealthy, silent partner, getting you closer to wary gobblers accessing untouched terrain and helping you outpace other hunters. A smart kayak setup doesn't just boost your odds, it transforms your entire turkey hunting experience. Now, when I was first approached about doing Paddling Adventures Radio as the online radio station, I said, well, let me go check out the radio station and what other shows are on there.
There's a lot of turkey hunting.
And I learned a lot about turkey hunting in in Michigan, which I then just put out of my brain, right? So this is sort of getting back into our roots. he says, my aha moment came early one spring morning when my noisy boat engine sent roosting turkeys scattering before I even stepped ashore. Killing the motor and switching to a trolling motor didn't help. The birds were already wise to my presence. That frustrating hunt taught me that stealth on the water was as crucial as stealth in the woods. See, that's what I'd be thinking is, okay, you can take your boat, you zip on up, but then you get out of your boat to go do your hunting.
Hmm.
Right? You don't just travel along the river
and shoot
taking pot shots, right? it took me a few more seasons to dial in my kayak setup and truly harness its advantages. Now, having refined my gear, tactics, and rigging, I'm consistently getting closer, hunting quieter, and filling tags faster. Here are the essential kayak rigging trips that'll spare you the trials and errors I've experienced and get you on gobblers sooner this turkey season. I'm a gear junkie as much as the next guy, but I end up miserable and frustrated every time I try to cram as much gear as possible into my kayak. In my experience, it's best to stay agile by limiting my gear during spring or fall hunts. If you don't remember anything else, remember to bring only what you need into the turkey woods. If you own a kayak, you likely have most of the gear you'll need for a successful hunt. For those who don't own a kayak, I recommend starting with a 10-foot fishing kayak. They don't make kayaks specifically designed for hunting yet.
Yeah, that's coming.
In the $1,000 to $1,500 range, I've listed kayaking gear I use when chasing Old Tom. It excludes my turkey hunting gear. So he has PFD, paddle, trolling motor, lithium ion battery, shotgun, and bow mounts. I guess he bow
hunting
mounts as
bow.
Well.
Yeah.
Navigation lights and LED lights. It's critical that you not only have a PFD on board, but also wear it. Paddlers are the highest percentage of boating fatalities, primarily due to lack of wearing a PFD. Don't be a part of the statistic. And if you're hunting and you get a turkey, you're going to be excited.
Yeah.
That little bit of excitement might
turn
you
some
into the
instability
water.
And yeah, exactly.
Next, even if you plan to use a motor or pedal kayak, always bring a paddle. The motor or pedal drive might break, so it's best to have a plan B. Motors are great if traveling far, but they can be a hassle otherwise. I use a trolling motor because it's virtually silent and isn't as heavy even with the battery. Lithium ion batteries are the only way to go in the kayak. They're lighter and produce more power than lead acid batteries of the same size.
And you see most people...
That seems to be the trend anymore.
Exactly,
anyway.
With kayaks and so on.
Yeah. I mounted the trolling motor to the stern of my kayak and placed the battery in the bow to distribute the weight better. So, yeah, battery in the front and motor in the back. I ran the wire through the hull to keep my deck clean and clear. So that involves you drilling a fishing it through,
yeah.
Right? Placing the battery in the bow also made installing the navigation and LED lights simple. Fewer wires to run. You'll need the lights if you plan to use your kayak before or after dark.
Yeah.
Like getting to your spot before sunup or staying after sundown. Because there's all, just 5 more minutes. Just 5 more minutes. Just 5 more minutes.
It's dark.
Yeah, I guess I'm camping here. One item I wouldn't overlook is a shotgun and bow mount. I'm currently using the Yak Attack gun mounts, but they've been discontinued. I recommend the Rail Blazer Gunhold.
Hmm. Yeah.
In its place. I like these mounts because they secure your gun or bow to the kayak, but remain easily accessible if you need to grab your gun quickly and go. See, and that makes me sound like, okay, grab it and go. So you're grabbing your gun, you're getting up and you're
going ashore.
Going ashore. I mount my shotgun on the right side of my kayak running parallel. This ensures my deck is open for other gear, but keeps my shotgun handy if I hear a gobble. You can also mount it perpendicular to your kayak, but I found it gets in the way more.
Makes sense.
Right?
Yep.
If you've got navigable water nearby, a kayak truly stands out as one of the best tools for bagging early or late season turkeys. By gliding silently across the water, you can approach wary birds that rarely expect a threat from the shoreline.
Yeah.
Kayak also extends your hunting range beyond areas accessible by foot or truck, allowing you to explore hidden coves and isolated stretches of shoreline that other hunters overlook. Or can't get to.
Yeah, on foot or by vehicle, exactly, yeah.
Moreover, its portability and ease of maneuvering mean you can rapidly adjust your location if conditions change or birds are unresponsive. Simply put, hunting from a kayak gives you unmatched versatility, stealth, and the advantage of surprise, helping you get closer, faster, and bag turkeys that other hunters never even see.
I never thought about it, but that all makes sense. It's
you know what? When you read it, it does make sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my cup of tea, like I
say. No, me neither, yeah.
I mean, but I'm sure we talk about fishing from kayaks and stuff, and that's not everybody's cup of tea. So I figure there's got to be more people out there that...
hunt from watercraft.
Hunt from the watercraft, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, yeah, if you got a kayak, you might want to check it out, think about it, and... give it a whirl and...
Very interesting.
Yeah. And if you find that this really does help you out, send us a line and let us know what time to be by for dinner.
Exactly.
Because apparently we're having turkey.
Make some jerky turkey.
Right? I got one more thing here. Science-y again.
Okay.
And pretty cool. I think it's pretty cool. We're just getting on to close to an hour, but we'll talk about this one anyway. Just a little behind the scenes sort of thing. When we get close to an hour, sometimes we look at what we have left, and then we'll just like, do we save this for next week, or do we just read it now? This one's cool.
This could be long.
Yeah, this could be long. Want to make it long? We'll just talk real slow. Just when you finally convinced yourself your career choice is making a difference, along comes Toby Minear and his work. Minear is a...
fluvial geomorphologist.
So we've just because Derek likes the word fluvial.
We've covered it a few times. Fluvial tsunami where the river changed flow upriver because of the... Mm-hmm.
That was way back in the 1800s.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
The biggie.
Yeah. And we've talked about it a couple other times. Anyways, it was just that one of those words that seems to keep coming back, but it makes sense. It's fluvial does describe the water.
Yeah.
The flow of water.
Fluvial geomorphologist. Someone tells me that's like made up.
Everything's made up.
That means... in his work at the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado, he studies surface water bodies, rivers mainly, and measures flow and conditions within them. He also worked with NASA on the Surface Water and Ocean Technologies Satellite, SWOT, which measures the height or surface level and width of water bodies larger than 10,000 square feet. And when it's time to check SWOT's work, he jumps in his kayak and takes field measurements of the rivers SWOT has observed. That part of his job has taken him down the Colorado and the South Platte, the Missouri and the Mississippi. He's also fact-checked the North Saskatchewan and Peace Athabasca Delta.
There you go.
Both in Alberta, Canada. And his work has critical global applications, especially in places like Africa and Greenland, which he says use few, if any, water tracking gauges.
It's amazing what satellites can, like, they've become so technological if you see an earthquake, some of these satellites can see micromillimeter movements on land and mm-hmm. and detect micromillimeter movements just from space. They can do space imaging, see through trees, and, you know, same thing we use LIDAR for. And there's a lot of studies that NASA's doing right now to measure water bodies and water tables in, like, Florida and California for to detect drought conditions and so on. So this is just another one of those things with space technology and satellite technology mm-hmm. to measure water surface changes.
It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we're basically trying to track how much water is where on the landscape. Currently, we don't have a sense of how much fresh water comes off the continents and flows into oceans. And that information is key to predicting things like changes in water supply and runoff into the sea. When you launch a satellite, particularly one like SWOT with many new instruments, there's a bunch of things you need to make sure are correct before the data is released. It's often not really clear if what you think is going to happen is actually what the satellite is measuring. So in our case, we put up the satellite a year and a half ago, and it has a new instrument designed to measure water surface widths and elevations. I checked to see if the measurements are real or if there are artifacts or other things going on with the satellite. So it says, here's what this is, and then he zips on out in his boat and double checks it.
Yeah. Confirms it, yeah.
SWOT mostly measures surface water bodies, so anything you can see with your eyes, and usually the bigger ones. The footprint of a house is usually the smallest size. We watch to see how much the volume of the body changes over time. As well, SWOT can see snow, but we can make a more reliable measurement of the water surface elevation and its area when the water is liquid. Then we look at the relative change between, say, last week and this week, or last year and this year, and that gives us the changes in water storage. That's useful because in Colorado, there are at least 3,000 water bodies that are big enough for SWOT to see, and virtually none of those have water gauges on them, so no one knows their storage capacity. Rivers are the same. There are gauges at a few locations, but in a lot of places, don't have them. If you want to know what a water level is at different flows or during a flood, you can look at SWOT data now.
That's awesome.
Which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
So far, SWOT has been very much in the hands of engineers and scientists because it's so new and people are just starting to work on it, and it has yet to make it into the water management side of things. Colorado has been thinking about it, using it to keep an eye on natural lakes and other water bodies. And people might be surprised to know how few lakes and water bodies are measured. I would guess roughly 5% or less. When we show the SWOT data to water managers, they are often amazed because they realize how difficult it would be to instrument the millions of water bodies that SWOT observes.
Oh, yeah.
Could you imagine having to put all, like, physical gauges and instruments on
every... The expenses
every
of building it and satellite uplinks and maintaining, and it's just the cost and human resources needed to get people out there to install this stuff. Yeah, and
this is next level.
You put up one satellite and you can read it all.
Yeah. Biggest bang for the buck right now is with SWOT is places that have no gauges. We don't really have many gauges in South America or Africa or Greenland, for example, and we want to keep an eye on places like the Mekong River where there's a bunch of dams being built.
Oh, yeah.
And no one is passing on any information about them. There are many transboundary river problems where a river crosses the border between two countries that are going to be highlighted because of SWOT. If there's a river that flows from one country into another and one country is holding back more water than is agreed upon, for example. Let's just throw that out there. Meneer is based in Boulder, Colorado, but he works with people all over the world. Satellite is built and run by NASA and partnered with space agencies from France, Canada, and the UK. Water is a globally important issue, and many of these countries realize it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
When asked, Meneer says he only gets to kayak only when the river is not too deep enough for motorized boats. When the satellite is moving, it's going very fast, like 24,000 kilometers an hour.
That's quite a speeding ticket.
I think I've driven that fast once in a while. and measuring over an area many hundreds of miles wide. To check the satellite measurements, we install water level equipment in a reach of river from 25 to 125 miles long that has relatively stable flow before the satellite goes overhead. When the satellite is overhead, we'll do a rundown the reach, typically in a motorized boat, with a high-grade GPS leveled to the water surface. To cover the largest amount of ground, we usually avoid kayaks, but sometimes kayaks are needed when the river is very low or we need to go a short distance. Still, 25 miles in a kayak with a bunch of gear at low flow makes for very long days. So that's pretty cool. That
yes.
New technology from satellites and...
I've been seeing little stories here and there about this new satellite, and they mentioned the Mekong Delta, the Mekong River. So that water hydroelectric project in China, they're saying that because of the mass of the amount of water that's going to be held back by this gigantic dam, it has the potential to change the rotational energy of the Earth. So we could be changing, you know how, you know, people who spin, you put your arms in tighter and it spins faster. Put your arms out, you slow
like
down.
Like a figure skater.
Yeah,
a
figure skater. So with that, for example, if you put a larger mass higher up at altitude, it's going to slow the Earth's rotation down. And so that's what they're looking at now to see what kind of effects something like that will cause on the rotation of the planet.
Hmm.
So it's interesting.
It is. Just on a side note from that, if the world stopped spinning, would you rather be in 24-hour night or day?
I don't think... nobody's ever asked me that before.
You've been asked now. How to stump Derek if the planet stopped spinning.
Well, clearly, if you're in 24 hours darkness, you're going to have to figure out how to grow and eat algae. But if you're in 24 hours day, you're just going to have to learn how to sleep in the sunlight. And you could.
So, do you want to sleep or do you want to eat?
I want to grow crops, so obviously in the sunlight.
Well, you'll be tired enough after a good day's work.
I wonder how that would work. Like, can you imagine what the geological forces would be like without the Earth spinning?
You know where I'd want to live?
On the moon?
Right on that spot where night and day join. I never gave you
right
that
on
option.
The edge of flat Earth?
Right on the edge of flat Earth. Yeah, the dark side of the Earth. Right. Anyway. So, yeah, lots of cool things going on with science these days, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from archaeology to the space
age.
Hot diggity.
100%.
You got anything else to talk about?
Yeah, what plant do you think we're going to first canoe on?
Jupiter.
I think maybe... not Jupiter. It's too big.
Needs more paddling days.
Europa. I think it'd be Europa.
Europa.
Which is a moon.
Yeah, you said planet.
I know.
Hey. Well, when we find out that the moon has those underwater lakes, or underground lakes.
Yeah, in the caves.
In the moon. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, we're going to the moon. Where are you guys going for vacation this year? The moon. I can't wait to say that. Where are you going? We're going to the moon for our holidays. Yes. No, we're not going to go spend it with Grandma this year.
Yeah.
We're going to the moon.
Interesting.
Settle down back there. I'll turn this spaceship around and we won't go to the moon.
I will turn this around and go right back to Earth.
Geez. All righty. So nothing further are you
no,
saying?
No. I'm afraid to bring anything up now.
Oh, we'll just go every which way. Well, you will find more about us. You can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream all our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, and Player FM. Or you can just go to the all your favorite podcast downloading sites and download them from there. Or just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com. You can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rooley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.